Welcome into the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast from Hoosier Ag Today. I'm Eric Pfeiffer, and I should correct that now because we have a new sponsor on board. It's the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. We thank them for jumping on board. And today's Indiana Ag Policy Podcast is coming from Washington, D.C. We're out here with our friends with the Indiana Corn Growers Association and Indiana Soybean Alliance. And we're out here, and we're with a bunch of corn and soybean growers from all over the country as we look to advocate for better corn and soybean policy. I'm here again with my buddy, the policy guy with the Indiana Corn and Soybean Group, Steve Howell. Steve, welcome again. Glad to have you here.
Either I'm back or I haven't left. I'm not sure which. Well, but I am. It's great to be with you, Eric.
We threw you in a bag. We brought you out to D.C. We wanted to make sure you were here with us. Just threw you in with all the equipment. So
that's the only way they let me in town anymore.
Amen. We had to sneak in. But we also have another Hoosier here with us that we just met here. Nancy Martinez is here. And Nancy, we're going to get your story here in a moment. But let me get this right. You're Director of Public Policy, Trade, and Biotechnology for the National Corn Growers Association. Did I nail it?
You did, Eric.
Okay, very good. So, Nancy, you are Indiana, born and bred, and you're from Marion County.
That's right.
That's right. So, you know, when we think Indiana agriculture, we don't necessarily think Marion County.
Yeah, I was actually a 10-year 4-H'er in Marion County. So, spent my summers at the county fair, sheep, goats, and chickens, and that was my life all throughout high school.
Now, being in Marion County, mm-hmm. you're going to have to tell me, how did this come to be?
Well, it actually came from my mom, who was a 4-H'er in Westfield, Indiana. So agriculture's been in my family for generations, and it was just kind of expected. That's what we did.
So now you're also going to have to explain to me, because, you know, when we talk about Indiana agriculture, we also, you know, start hearing this whole, you know, boiler up, hammer down thing. But that's not what we're going to hear from you either.
No. You're going to hear a lot of go Hoosiers. Okay. I'm a graduate of Indiana University. Very proud of that.
Okay. All right. So you're going to have to, how did that come to be? What was the area of study there at IU? You're going to have to explain all this to me. We've got a lot of boilers to listen to this thing.
So my joke is that I majored in the two things you're not supposed to talk about at the dinner table, politics and religion. So that was my major at IU.
So what do you talk about at the dinner table? My goodness.
You know, the ag.
Ag, there we go. Okay, well, you know, that helps here on this particular podcast, talking about politics. That's what we're going to do here on the Ag Policy Podcast. And I guess first we should probably just kind of, you know, get this out of the way and talk through kind of how your organization, Steve, Nancy, how this all works together here, the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the National Corn Growers Association. Steve, kind of clue us in here how all this works together.
Sure. As a member of the Indiana Corn Growers Association, if you're a corn farmer in Indiana, we'd love to have you as a member. Part of that membership, when you join the Indiana Corn Growers Association, you also become a member of the National Corn Growers Association. And that's it's a really strong partnership where the Indiana Corn Growers Association can advocate on state and local issues kind of firsthand, since that's where we are. But we need this national partnership with the National Corn Growers Association because so much of the advocacy needs to happen right here in Washington, D.C. This is where the Congress is held. This is where the administration is housed and where a lot of the activity needs to happen to have boots on the ground here in Washington, D.C., watching out for Indiana corn farmers.
And this is where you hang out, right? And like these are your grounds, right? This is where you haunt. This is it.
Yes, for better or for worse. So, you know, NCGA, we've got an office in Washington, D.C., though we are based in St. Louis. So as part of, you know, my job in DC, I handle the trade and biotech portfolio. And then we have other staffers that specialize in different policy areas like ethanol, like sustainability, like transportation. And then my job is to coordinate, you know, with the Hill, with Congress, and also with the administration to make sure that our priorities for corn growers are at the top of their mind, especially when they're designing policies, and especially with regards to markets and trade.
So that's kind of the tie-in here. So you do represent Indiana farmers. You are a Hoosier.
Yes.
In fact, as I understand it, you know, prior to your time with NCGA, you were a staffer for, was it Senator Young?
I was.
Okay.
Yep.
So you're familiar with back home again in Indiana. You're one of us. So,
absolutely.
Okay. So now that we've got that all squared away, we can trust you, Nancy, all right? So let's talk through here some of these issues that are facing corn growers in Indiana as it relates to your area of expertise with trade. This has been a really hot topic of late in particular. Let's just say here, especially over the last, can we call it 8 years here, Steve? I mean, really over the past 8 years, this trade issue has been something really that has come to the forefront. As you look over the past 8 years, is that the timeline that you would put on it here too, Nancy?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we're always going to need market access. If you look at the things that corn needs in order to be successful, it's market access, which is trade, ethanol, and livestock consumption. So if we don't have one of those three key pillars, you know, we're really struggling in terms of what we can expect.
I mean, when you mentioned earlier, Steve, before we came on air, you know, tariffs. This was a word that in your career, spanning back to what, 1980?
Yeah, it's been a little. It's a lot of years for such a young-looking man. Let's say.
I think you might have actually mentioned the year that I was born, Steve, but I won't go there. It's one of those words that we just hadn't really heard a whole lot of. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Trump comes into office, and this is a word that now is, you know, really in here, and it hits hard and heavy every time it's mentioned. How has that word, Nancy, tariff, how has it changed the landscape of this whole trade arena for agriculture and for corn growers?
Yeah, I definitely think it's made an impact. I would say that the United States is not making and constructing free trade agreements at the same rate as our partners. And we're really losing out because of that. So when we think of proactive trade policies, you know, if we don't take that approach to find new customers and sell our high quality corn, then we're really going to have a hard time. So when we're talking about, you know, different tariff measures, you know, I would just like to put the perspective of, you know, we have to think about what's good for our market access and how that could impact our ability long term with customers abroad. You know, I will also say that, you know, economic retaliation is something that, you know, we think of too when we're trying to design policies in the trade space for agriculture. You know, our corn growers have a lot of influence in D.C. So, you know, if they're impacted negatively by any sort of trade measure, they will definitely be advocating about the harm that's caused them.
When we look at what's happening right now, we are currently at a 15 billion dollar ag trade deficit. Am I correct in those numbers? Am I in the ballpark?
Yes,
here?
Yes, you are.
You know, how did we get here, and how do we get back? You know, how do we get, this is the largest ever. How do we get back from this, and how are corn growers being impacted by that number? I know it's not the entire 15 billion in corn. I know soybean growers are really taking it on the chin there. How are corn growers impacted by this?
So we definitely have to be more aggressive with finding those new markets, like I mentioned, but also strengthening the markets that we do have. We look at where our corn is going in the world. Mexico is our biggest customer by far. But then it kind of ranges in terms of what's next. So, you know, Japan, Taiwan, Colombia, they're all key buyers of U.S. corn. China, not so much anymore. And it's because Brazil has really come onto the market and proliferated, you know, the global markets with their corn production. So, you know, we are actually kind of looking at Brazil, who's taking more and more of our market share, and just kind of, you know, wondering how we can get those customers back that we once had.
How do we do that? More complicated. I mean, it's easier than it, than, you know, easier said than done, right?
Right. And I do think it starts with, you know, the administration being proactive on trade discussions, but also us fighting through some of the barriers to trade, like what Mexico is doing in biotechnology with their ban on GM corn. So I think addressing some of those key issues can definitely help bridge that gap when we try to find new markets.
See, Steve, this is why you call me the radio guy. That's what they call a segue right there.
I set it up for you nicely.
You did. You put it right on a tee there for me. So this issue with Mexico and genetically modified corn, this GM corn, this one just kind of came out of left field, right? Like, we had no idea this was really coming. I've spoken with Ted McKinney, former USDA Undersecretary for Trade, about this, and he's like, whoa, come on, guys. Like, where? Why? It doesn't make any sense. I think that we're still there. We still don't know why this makes any sense, and it really doesn't. But we're still dealing with this. No one has rolled back the clock on this, been like, yep, you're right, America. This doesn't make any sense. We're still going through with it. Like, no one has said that. Like, it just, we're still going through this dispute panel through the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. But I think that, you know, from a media standpoint, I guess this is where I can speak for my expertise for once. I don't have a whole lot of that, Steve can attest. We've kind of let this go to the back burner a bit because we're just under the assumption that maybe with the presidential election down there, we've got a new president coming in here soon, that maybe this thing will just float away. But that's not... that's not really a fix. And we don't know for sure that that's going to happen. Where does this thing sit right now, Nancy?
Right. So I will say, from NCGA's perspective, this is our number one trade issue, and we are definitely prioritizing it with everything that we've got. So, you know, the U.S. Trade Representative, they started a formal dispute settlement process under USMCA. So that started with technical consultations that did not convince the Mexican authority to back down. So then they proceeded with this formal panel. So the panel has three panel members. Those were named last year. So right now, the panel just completed a public hearing at the end of June, and then they will work on a final report that will come out in November.
It seems like it takes a long time. Should it take this long? Like, how do you get on this three-member board panel, by the way?
It's actually a process set forth in USMCA. So it's fairly fairly prescripted already. But the timelines have been set. So we're almost on track to meeting them. It's slightly delayed because of translation. But, you know, we are committed to seeing the whole process play out, and we want it to, and we want it to stay on schedule.
Is there a way of knowing at this point, like, you know, how it went? Do we have a sense of, you know what, I think we did really well here, and I think this thing might go our way? Is there a way of knowing how we did?
Yeah, we definitely watched the entire public hearing over June 26th and 27th. I thought the U.S. lawyers made a really great case that the science is on our side, that Mexico did not conduct an appropriate risk assessment. So, you know, they made a lot of good points that I think will really kind of ring true throughout this process. You know, one thing that Mexico argues over and over again is that their population consumes more corn than anywhere else in the world. So therefore, that they are at an increased exposure. But the U.S. lawyers made the case that if they did conduct a risk assessment, that would have been part of the risk assessment. Exposure is part of any risk assessment by international standards. So I thought the U.S. did a great job to combat some of the Mexican arguments. And we'll have to see in November.
How big of a hit did the U.S. take during this? Mm-hmm. And if it were to stick, how big of a hit would it be going forward? How big of a hit to U.S. corn growers would this be if this thing doesn't get resolved?
Yeah, there are multi levels of effects here with this GM corn ban. First, it's a huge loss for science and biotech. So if for some reason, the panel decision does not come out in our favor, it would significantly undermine the 1,700 studies that have been done by, good organizations about the science here. So we have that. Other countries could also follow in Mexico's steps. You know, they could take measures like Mexico just for the sole fact of trying to knock U.S. imports out of their markets in an effort to prop up their own domestic industries. So we definitely don't want that to occur either. I will say too, there's this huge loss of innovation that can happen. Companies aren't going to be willing to invest in new traits or new technology if the market access is so uncertain, if a country is going to ban that technology. And then when we also talk about real impacts, white corn exports have significantly dropped going to Mexico. And yellow corn efforts too. There's a part of the decree that wants to phase out that yellow corn for animal feed. The Mexican government walked that back recently, but it's still kind of floating out there. Corn is corn. If it's safe for humans, it'll be safe for animals on the GM side. So we definitely want everybody to realize all these different layers of impacts.
Do we have an idea, Steve, of what that does at the local level? What the impact is?
No, it certainly would be a major impact if we can't get this to come out in our favor. As she said, as Nancy mentioned, Mexico is our largest customer for U.S. corn, and we need those products to produce efficiently and sustainably produce corn in Indiana. So we definitely need to have access to that biotech market. And I think more importantly here is that it is kind of a, in some respects, kind of an annoying process. Or, why do we have to go through this? USMCA was just agreed upon, ratified just a few years ago, and here we are arguing about a piece of that. But I think it's important to see this process through, because as we suspect, they will rule in our favor. But that'll strengthen that agreement, and it'll keep future flare-ups, I would say, of disagreement or disputes from happening if it gets settled, if at least this piece gets settled appropriately.
I think that one thing that jumped out at me during what you were talking about there, Nate, I know that you represent the corn farmers in Indiana, and that's a big piece of this. But I think in Indiana especially, we have some companies that are they're pretty big in this corn space. Mm-hmm. I can think of many of them off the top of my head here. Corteva, Pioneer, Bex. I mean, there are some companies here that might be being held back from an innovation standpoint.
Farmers that producing white corn, that could be a very direct hit if that Mexico market were to shut down for them. So it's very important. It's not white corn in Indiana is not a big market, but it's an important piece, a way a producer can diversify, produce white corn.
And I will say too, if other countries take the same approach as Mexico, that will hurt with our ability to find those new markets and expand those markets. So if we sort of allow this trend to occur, that's going to really stunt the growth of our market access opportunities.
Yeah. This could get ugly if things don't go our way. And, we haven't had a great track record with the USMCA stuff thus far. Hopefully that turns around here and we get things moving in the right direction. Any other issues right now with Mexico? Or are we good otherwise? Or we need to get this one taken care of and we should be good?
Yeah, I would say this is definitely the main focus of ours. You know, the regulatory system in Mexico has not always been straightforward on the biotech approval process, for sure. So, you know, I think getting clarity in this USMCA case will do a lot, hopefully, you know, with the regulatory approach there.
Okay. Moving on, you know, there were some other issues that we talked about before we, you know, hit the record button on this thing, and I want you to have a chance to go through some of these. We talked about tariffs. Let's go back to that a little bit. Some ongoing investigations by Commerce. Mm-hmm. Jump into that here, Nancy. Talk to me about these issues and what it is you're looking at from your standpoint.
Absolutely. So there's a couple different Commerce investigations that NCGA is really active with. You know, we're concerned about costs being passed down to farmers, first and foremost. So there's one investigation into phosphate imports. So, you know, we're concerned about tariffs on incoming phosphate. We don't want that to be passed down to farmers. And then a new case that just came online a few months ago into imports of the herbicide 2,4-D. We don't want that either to that financial burden to be passed on to farmers. I will say not just tariffing these imports will result in a cost issue, but it's also a supply chain issue. You know, farmers need access to the things at the right time so they can meet their individual needs. Tariffs have, you know, kind of a twofold approach. Not only do they raise that cost, but it hurts in terms of where they can move it and get it to the right place across the country.
Tariffing. I hadn't heard that one yet, but I think it works. I think it's absolutely, yeah, that's the right terminology. But we've been talking about the, you know, costs for farmers. I mean, they're not going down anytime soon for any reason whatsoever. They continue to go up, and this is just another reason why. I mean, they're
right.
The costs on everything are going up. And there's no relief in sight. So this is just another reason to, you know, we got to watch out for these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and phosphate in particular as a fertilizer. So fertilizers are already 30 to 40% of all the input costs for farmers. So, you know, some other increase here could really cause some turmoil.
This is something, you know, the fertilizer market, this is something NCGA's been, how long has this been going on now that we've been involved in this particular battle?
Yeah, well before I came on board NCGA, so at least a few years. But, you know, I know NCGA has been totally committed to making sure that farmers have options, and that's what this all boils down to.
I mean, you brought up the supply chain, and I'm like, are we really going back to, what, 2020 now? Because this whole supply chain thing was back in COVID. I remember, you know, we've got your your ag policy summit. I say technology because you're adding the technology piece to your ag policy summit this year, Steve. But you know, that was the theme here just a couple years back was, you know, the supply chain and whether or not we're getting things back to normal. I think normal's a weird term now. No one knows what normal is anymore.
You know, we don't, but what we do know is that there have been some relief on supply chain issues. We want to avoid any future supply chain issues if we can. And like Nancy said, that's a concern that if tariffs were to disrupt the supply chain, that would be a big hit to farmers. And we need to have access to the products when we need them, not a few months later when it's too late. So we are trying to stay ahead of some of these issues and provide a better environment for farmers to operate.
Yeah. Also, Brazil, ethanol. This is something that you've been working on for a while too, right?
Yes. So Brazil currently has an 18% tariff on ethanol, which has really closed out that market entirely for American ethanol producers. That tariff was actually raised in January. It was at 16%. So we've been working with the administration to try to make some headway with discussions with Brazil on this. You know, we submitted some comments in one of the comment periods that Brazil has open on tariffs. So, you know, we really want reciprocity recognized with Brazil because Brazil can import ethanol into the U.S. At a much lower duty rate. So, you know, we're hoping to make some headway and put some pressure on those ag negotiations with Brazil.
Say, why wouldn't they be able to reciprocate?
They don't want to.
So it's a complicated issue, you know, going back to what WTO can allow for each country to kind of put different percentage of tariffs on, you know, but I want to remind everybody that there was a period where it was, you know, pretty equal treatment between the Brazil and the U.S., and we would like to get to that point with ethanol.
What other places could we be sending ethanol to that we would, you know, really benefit from being able to do that? Are there other markets out there where, you know what, we could really open things up if we could go here?
Yeah, so Canada is a great market for U.S. ethanol exports, you know, our biggest market and growing. So there's always, you know, room to grow there. And also looking at India, they would be a great market to kind of explore, you know, more on the vehicle side, even though they have that ban in there in the country. But we do think there's a lot of opportunity there for ethanol exports.
Let's take a time out here, and this is where we would normally take a time out, and I would play a commercial, but I have Steve right here, and Steve, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that we do have a new sponsor for the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. It is the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance, and it just so happens you represent these folks, Steve.
I do work on behalf of the farmers, the soybean farmers and the corn farmers in Indiana who are members of the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance Membership and Policy Committee. So it's an honor to work for them. And part of our work, as we're discussing today, is the national groups that we partner with. Again, we can't be everywhere. As a farmer, can't make time to have a meeting with the Department of Commerce out here in Washington, D.C. If you're a member, we cover that for you. I handle a lot of the, again, a lot of the state and local issues, work with NCGA and for the soybean farmers, soybean members, work with the American Soybean Association out here in D.C. along with NCGA to advance our issues. I do work quite a bit with our federal delegation, so the House members and our two senators from Indiana work directly with them. To help build those relationships, to get farmers in front of them, to explain how different policies impact farms, and to also work with that delegation to help explain modern agriculture, commercial scale agriculture, the volumes that we handle, the complexity of the industry, the technology that we need access to operate a modern commercial scale farm. So that's kind of where I fit in, again, working with these national groups to get these issues covered for Indiana farmers.
And again, the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance Membership and Policy Committee, these are membership and policy organizations, mm-hmm. not covered with your checkoff dollars. You do want to become a member of these organizations. And the way I kind of look at it, Steve, is if you pay that membership, okay, you pay those dues, if you will, mm-hmm. You can kind of have whatever level of commitment to it that you want. You can pay the membership, and you can let Steve here be your representative and go mm-hmm. out and do all these meetings, take all these meetings, or you can pay the membership. You can submit to run for the board, and you can get involved. Mm-hmm. You can do that and come out here to Washington, D.C., where we are. You can be part of you know, the meetings and some of these action teams out here. You can come out and you can come and come out on the Hill and join, like we're going to go do tomorrow, and go meet with some of the congressional staffers. You can kind of get as involved as you want to get once you make that membership commitment and pay. I mean, that's what this is all about.
Yeah, and we have members who only want to join. They know that the work can get done. They don't have the time to commit to getting away from the farm to get to engage themselves. So they know that staff and other farmers will represent them. So they do join. We have others who join, and they do take the opportunity to serve and to engage more, because we do need those farmer voices. We need that story from the farm to carry out here to Washington, so policymakers understand what the impact of these decisions have on their industry.
And you need the ones that have the big barns that you can hold the shop talks in back home. I mean, again, a lot of different opportunities to get involved, or to not, but still make sure your voice is heard in a way that's going to benefit you on the farm from policy standpoint. Just a lot of different ways to do it.
Yep. Regardless of size, if you're producing corn or soybeans in Indiana, you need to be a member so we can cover these issues for you.
incornandsoy.org is the place to go if you want to learn more about becoming a member of the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance Membership and Policy Committee. You're tuned in to the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, brought to you by those organizations, and we thank them for that. And we're here with Nancy Martinez, Director of Public Policy, Trade, and Biotechnology for the National Corn Growers Association. We've touched on investigations from the Commerce Department. We've talked about Brazil ethanol tariffs. We've talked about the Mexico biotech issue, which is a big one that we've been dealing with for some time now. Again, hopefully we've got some resolution to that come November. Let's talk about just demand overall and where it might come from. You know, this we've touched on this before, Steve, and this is kind of where the checkoff and the policy organizations kind of intermingle here. You know, the checkoff, they're always searching for that demand, but we've got to have the policy that can make it all happen. Where can we go? Where are the different parts of the world? You touched on India a little bit. Where are the parts of the world where we think that it could be advantageous if we could put something together here from a policy standpoint for corn growers, Nancy?
Yeah, you know, one part of the world that I don't hear enough about is Africa. So there are many countries in Africa that have countrywide bans on biotechnology, which prevents us from being able to export or from them to buying some of our biotech products. So I really think in terms of the next frontier and where we can, you know, expand some market access, it would be looking at Africa. And as countries move kind of from that developing category to the developed category, that middle class will eat more protein, which is great for corn growers because livestock industry needs corn in order to, you know, produce their herds.
Why is it that we are still dealing with this, and that's how I'm going to put this, just to be frank, why is it we're still dealing with this ban on biotech stuff? Like, we've been doing it here in the U.S. Like, what further explanations, what further education do we have to do to do away with this? Like, what else can we do?
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, biotech has a good story to tell, and telling that story will help, you know, in terms of bridging that I guess, public misunderstanding. You know, biotech has a lot of benefits with sustainability, trying to be able to withstand some of those weather challenges that African countries experience, like drought. You know, biotech can withstand pesticides, pests. So that will be able to produce higher yields for those different countries. Also a more nutritious product, you know, if that's, you know, one of the goals of getting that higher quality of crop.
It just seems like, you know, some time ago, there was just this misinformation campaign, right? And we just haven't been able to come back from it, Steve. It's just,
yeah,
it's frustrating at times.
It certainly is frustrating, particularly for farmers and others that are involved in agriculture, because we've seen just what you just mentioned. We've seen an increase in yields. Our sustainability story is stronger. We have fewer passes across the field. We have less runoff. Because of biotech, we're able to adopt practices that are more sustainable because of biotech. We have weather, you know, last year, perfect example. The June crop did not look good at all, but we have the technology in those seeds that can withstand those dry spells, and, you know, we ended up with one of the best crops we ever had in Indiana because we have the technology in those seeds to weather the storm. It is really frustrating because we've seen it firsthand. We've seen it firsthand for, what, 30 years now, that it works and it's safe. It is frustrating. However, that's what we're dealt. We got to keep keep in the fight. We got to keep telling the story of the corn farmer, why all this matters. And I think we have some wins over the years. Unfortunately, we haven't had a grand slam, but we've knocked down a few singles here and there. But we're always going to go to the plate and swing for the fence. How's that?
Yeah, we'll take it. We'll take it. Nancy, do you find it right now? You know, obviously, we're still trying to get a farm bill done. Mm-hmm. All right, we're trying. Steve over here is probably going to tell me that he's still optimistic it can happen, and he and I can disagree until the cows come home. I just don't think it's going to happen. I'm a pessimist. That's maybe just me. Do you find it difficult right now as we're trying to get that taken care of? You know, there's been, and again, these are my words, not yours. There's been a lot right now of frustration, I think, with the Biden administration not focusing on trade. It's just been, you know, and maybe it's coming from the Trump administration where it felt like all they talked about was trade, whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. That's all they talked about was trade, to where in the Biden administration we never talk about trade. Is it difficult to even get a conversation going about trade in this administration, especially while we're trying to get this farm bill taken care of? Like, is it kind of like a one-track thing right now? Like, can we even get that conversation started while we're still trying to have this one?
Yeah, I mean, we're always going to talk about trade with the administration, regardless if they're actively pursuing FTAs or not. We're always going to bring it up. And I will say that there is a lot of refreshed momentum on the Hill. There's a new House Ag Trade Caucus that was just established. So we've got a whole new forum to engage, you know, with different industry partners, but also with the administration directly. And, you know, the administration is conducting these trade discussions, these economic framework pieces. So whether they call it an FTA or not, the discussions and, you know, the different methods are occurring just in a weaker way. But we're always going to advocate for those market access pieces and any sort of trade initiative by the administration.
What else, Nancy? What else are we missing here? What else do we need to discuss here that's happening in the NCGA trade realm? Anything else on your plate right now?
Yeah, I would just, you know, hammer home market access is so key to everything that we stand for at NCGA and everything that our corn growers need. So all these different regulatory pieces that we are fighting, these different issues with various countries. I mean, it all boils down to what we need to drive demand for corn growers. So we're really focused on that. We're working on these issues, you know, concurrently with other things, and we'll keep prioritizing it.
And I imagine, Steve, when farmers hit the Hill tomorrow to meet with congressional staffers, this is a point of conversation as well that they're going to be talking about. Obviously, I'm guessing the farm bill is going to come up.
Yeah, we're going to push for a comprehensive farm bill. We need it. Yep. Legislative days are dwindling, so I hate saying this, Eric, but you may be right. But I still am optimistic. I think part of the reason we're in this pickle that we're in is because of politics. That's why it was delayed. That's why we're having to operate under an extension of the 2018 Farm Bill, and that's why we've kind of drug on through this year and without a whole lot of action. We have seen some. So it is frustrating. But it's because of politics is why we're here. Politics can change pretty quickly, as we've seen over the past few days, actually.
Yeah.
So if the politics change enough to where members of Congress realize they need to act on a farm bill, I think they could get it done. However, each day that goes by means fewer legislative days, so it is concerning. But regardless of the hand we're dealt, we're going to be representing corn and soybean farmers very actively through the state associations and with our national partners.
Are you hearing anything? Are you giving any credence to any of these rumors of not even doing another extension of the 2018 Farm Bill? There are rumors out there. I don't know how much credence I'm giving it at this point, but some saying, you know what, I'm not even in for this. If we don't get a new one done, I'm not worrying about extending the old one either.
I think there's always going to be those factions on both sides of the aisle that that may take that approach, but I'm convinced that the majority of the House and the majority of the Senate, both sides of the aisle, understand the importance of a farm bill. And I think if you know, if there's an opportunity to get it done, they will. If not, I think we will see an extension. I don't think we'll just let the current law expire.
That's where you and I can agree.
Okay.
That's where we can meet in the middle there. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us on today's Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. It was good to hear from another Hoosier out here in D.C.
Thank you.
Even if you are an actual Indiana Hoosier and not a Boilermaker, I hope people stayed tuned in. I'm sure they did. Yeah, I mean, come on, you're a 10-year 4-H member.
Exactly.
They had to hear from you. No, thank you. This was good stuff. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
The Indiana Ag Policy Podcast is presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance and is a presentation of Hoosier Ag Today, Indiana's Farm Network.